This is the 27th episode of J.H. Merle de Bignet's History of the Reformation in England, and this chapter is entitled The Severities of Popery, 1526-28. Oxford and Cambridge, which alike shared the glories of the new learning in early Tudor days, and which were both deeply stirred by Reformation teaching, were alike also in their experience of persecution. It was in 1526 that the party of reform in the city on the Cam received its baptism of suffering. Early in February that year, two of Wolsey's agents, Dr. Capon, one of his chaplains, and Gibson, a sergeant at arms, notorious for his arrogance, left London for Cambridge. Submission was the password of popery. Yes, submission was responded from every part of Christendom by men of sincere piety and profound understanding. Submission to the legitimate authority against which Roman Catholicism has rebelled. According to their views, the traditionalism and Pelagianism of the Romish Church had set up the supremacy of fallen reason in opposition to the divine supremacy of the Word and of grace. The external and apparent sacrifice of self which Roman Catholicism imposes, obedience to a confessor or to the Pope, arbitrary penance, ascetic practices and celibacy, only served to create and so to strengthen and perpetuate a delusion as to the egotistic preservation of a sinful personality. When the Reformation proclaimed liberty, so far as regarded ordinances of human invention, it was with the view of bringing man's heart and life into subjection to their real sovereign. The reign of God was commencing, and that of the priests must needs come to an end. No man can serve two masters. Such were the important truths which gradually dawned upon the world, and which Wolsey and countless others thought it necessary to extinguish without delay. On the day after their arrival in Cambridge, Capon and Gibson went to the Convocation House, where several of the doctors were talking together. Their appearance caused some anxiety among the spectators, who looked upon the strangers with distrust. On a sudden, Gibson moved forward, put his hand on Barnes, and arrested him in the presence of his friends. The latter were frightened, and this was what the sergeant wanted. "What," said they, "the prior of the Augustines, the restorer of letters in Cambridge, arrested by a sergeant?" This was not all. Wolsey's agents were to seize the books come from Germany, and their owners, Bilney, Latimer, Stafford, Arthur, and their friends, were all to be imprisoned, for they possessed the New Testament. 30 members of the university were pointed out as suspected, and some miserable wretches, who had been bribed by the inquisitors, offered to show the place in every room where the prohibited books were hidden. But while the necessary preparations were making for this search, Bilney, Latimer, and their colleagues, being warned in time, got the books removed. They were taken away not only by the doors, but by the windows, even by the roofs, and anxious inquiry was made for sure places in which they could be concealed. This work was hardly ended when the Vice-Chancellor of the University, the Sergeant-at-Arms, Wolsey's chaplain, the proctors, and the informers began their rounds. They opened the first room, entered, searched, and found nothing. They passed on to the second. There was nothing. The sergeant was astonished and grew angry. On reaching the third room, he ran directly to the place that had been pointed out. Still, there was nothing. The same thing occurred everywhere. Never was inquisitor more mortified. He dared not lay hands on the persons of the evangelical doctors. His orders read that he was to seize the books and their owners. But as no books were found, there could be no prisoners. However, there was one man, the prior of the Augustines, against whom there were more particular charges. The sergeant promised to compensate himself at Barnes' expense for his useless labours. The next day, Gibson and Capon set out for London with Barnes. During this mournful journey, the prior, in great agitation, at one time determined to brave all England, and at another trembled like a leaf. At last their journey was ended. The chaplain left his prisoner at Parnell's house, close by the stocks. Three students, Coverdale, Goodwin, and Field, had followed their master to cheer him with their tender affection. On Thursday, the 8th of February, the sergeant conducted Barnes to the Cardinal's palace at Westminster. The wretched prior, whose enthusiasm had given way to dejection, waited all day before he could be admitted. What a day! Will no one come to his assistance? Dr. Gardiner, Wolsey's secretary, and Fox, his steward, both old friends of Barnes, passed through the gallery in the evening and went up to the prisoner, who begged them to procure him an audience with the cardinal. These officers agreed to introduce the prior into the room where their master was sitting, and Barnes, as was customary, fell on his knees before him. "Is this the Dr. Barnes who is accused of heresy?" asked Wolsey, in a haughty tone, of Fox and Gardiner. They replied in the affirmative. The cardinal then, turning to Barnes, who was still kneeling, said to him ironically and not without reason, "What, Master Doctor, had you not sufficient scope in the scriptures to teach the people, but my golden shoes, my poleaxes, my pillars, my golden cushions, my crosses, did so sore offend you that you must make us a laughingstock, ridiculum caput, amongst the people? We were jollily that day laughed to scorn. Verily, it was a sermon more fit to be preached on a stage than in a pulpit, for at the last you said I wore a pair of red gloves, eh? What think you, Master Doctor?" Barnes, wishing to elude these embarrassing questions, answered vaguely, "I spoke nothing but the truth out of the scriptures, according to my conscience and according to the old doctors." He then presented to the cardinal a statement of his teaching. Wolsey received the papers with a smile. "Oh ho," said he, as he counted the 6 sheets, "I perceive you intend to stand to your articles and to show your learning." "By the grace of God," said Barnes. Wolsey then began to read them and stopped at the 6th article, which ran thus: "I will never believe that one man may, by the law of God, be bishop of 2 or 3 cities, yea, of a whole country, for it is contrary to St. Paul, who saith, I have left thee behind to set in every city a bishop." Barnes did not quote correctly, for the apostle says to ordain elders in every city. That's Titus 1:5. Wolsey was displeased at this thesis. "Ah, this touches me," he said. "Do you think it wrong, seeing the ordinance of the church, that one bishop should have so many cities underneath him?" "I know of no ordinance of the church," Barnes replied, "as concerning this thing, but Paul's saying only." Although this controversy interested the cardinal, the personal attack of which he had to complain touched him more keenly. "Good," said Wolsey, and then with a condescension hardly to be expected from so proud a man, he deigned almost to justify himself. "You charge me with displaying a royal pomp, but do you not understand that, being called to represent His Majesty, I must strive by these means to strike terror into the wicked?" "'Tis not your pomp or your poleaxes," Barnes courageously answered, "that will save the king's person. God will save him, who said, Parmi reges regnant, by me kings reign." Barnes, instead of profiting by the cardinal's kindness to present an humble justification, as Dean Colet had formerly done to Henry VIII, dared preach him a second sermon to his face. Wolsey felt the colour mount to his cheeks. "Well, gentlemen," said he, turning to Fox and Gardiner, "you hear him. Is this the wise and learned man of whom you spoke to me?" At these words, both steward and secretary fell on their knees, saying, "We desire your grace to be good unto him, for he will be reformable." "Do you not know," said Wolsey to Barnes, "that I am Legatus de Latere, and that I am able to dispense on all matters concerning religion within this realm as much as the Pope may?" Barnes replied, "I know it to be so." "Will you then be ruled by us, and we will do all things for your good and for the good of the university?" He answered, "I thank your grace for your goodwill. I will stick to the Holy Scripture and to God's book, according to the simple talent that God hath lent me." "Well," replied Wolsey, "thou shalt have thy learning tried to the utmost, and thou shalt have the law." Orders were then given that he should be taken to the Tower, but Gardiner and Fox offered to become his sureties, and Wolsey permitted him to pass the night at the house of a Master Parnell. He spent most of the night in writing and did not sleep. The next day he was taken into the chapter house at Westminster and re-examined before Islip, Abbot of Westminster, and sundry bishops. His judges laid before him a long statement and said to him, "Promise to read this paper in public without omitting or adding a single word." It was then read to him. "I would die first," was his reply. "Will you abjure or be burnt alive?" said his judges. "Take your choice." The alternative was dreadful. A prey to the deepest agony, Barnes shrank at the thought of the stake. Then suddenly his courage revived, and he exclaimed, "I would rather be burnt than abjure." Gardiner and Fox did all they could to persuade him. "Listen to reason," said they craftily. "Your articles are true. That is not the question. We want to know whether by your death you will let error triumph, or whether you would rather remain to defend the truth when better days may come." They entreated him. They put forward the most plausible motives. That's very subtle, isn't it? From time to time they uttered the terrible words, "burnt alive." His blood froze in his veins. He knew not what he said or did. They placed a paper before him. They put a pen in his hand. His head was bewildered. He signed his name with a deep sigh. This unhappy man was destined at a later period to be a faithful martyr of Jesus Christ. But he had not yet learnt to resist even unto blood. Barnes had fallen. I wonder what we would do in that situation. On the following Sunday morning, a solemn spectacle was preparing at St. Paul's. Before daybreak, all were astir in the prison of the unhappy prior, and at 8 o'clock, the night marshal with his tipstaves and the warden of the Fleet Prison with his billmen conducted Barnes to the St. Paul's, along with four of the Hans merchants who had been first brought to London the New Testament of Jesus Christ in English. The fifth of these pious merchants held an immense taper, 5 pounds in weight, in his hands. The persevering search had discovered that it was these men to whom England was indebted for the so much dreaded book. Their warehouses were surrounded and their persons arrested. On the top of St. Paul's steps was a platform, and on the platform a throne, and on the throne the cardinal dressed in purple. On his head glittered the mitre of which Barnes had spoken so ill. Around him were 36 bishops, abbots, priors, and all his doctors, dressed in damask and satin. The cathedral held a vast congregation. The Bishop of Rochester, having gone into a pulpit placed at the top of the steps, Barnes and the merchants, each bearing a faggot, were compelled to kneel and listen to a sermon intended to cure these poor creatures of that taste for insurrection against popery which was beginning to spread in every quarter. The sermon ended. Dr. Barnes was then required to declare that he was more charitably handled than he deserved, and to ask pardon for all his heresies. All this done, the cardinal took his station under a magnificent canopy, moved with his escort of bishops to the cathedral gate, mounted his mule, and rode off. After this, Barnes and his five companions walked 3 times round a fire, lighted before the cross at the north gate of the cathedral. The dejected prior, with downcast head, dragged himself along rather than walked. After the 3rd turn, the prisoners threw their faggots into the flames. Some heretical, inverted commas, books were also flung in, and the Bishop of Rochester, having given absolution to the 6 penitents, they were led back to prison to be kept there during the Lord Cardinal's pleasure. Barnes could not weep now. He thought of his relapse and of the effects so guilty an example might produce, had deprived him of all moral energy. In the month of August he was led out of prison and confined in the Augustine Monastery. Barnes was not the only man at Cambridge upon whom the blow had fallen. Since the year 1520, a monk named Richard Bayfield had been an inmate of the Abbey of Bury St. Edmunds. His affability delighted every traveller. One day, when engaged as chamberlain in receiving Barnes, who had come to visit Dr. Ruffham, his fellow student at Louvain, 2 men entered the monastery. They were pious persons and of great consideration in London, where they carried on the occupation of brick-making, and had risen to be wardens of their guild. Their names were Maxwell and Stacy, men well grafted in the doctrine of Christ, says the historian, who had led many to the Saviour by their conversation and exemplary life. Being accustomed to travel once a year through the counties to visit their brethren and extend the knowledge of the gospel, they used to lodge, according to the usages of the time, in the monasteries and abbeys. A conversation soon arose between Barnes, Stacy, and Maxwell, which struck the lay brother. Barnes, who had observed his attention, gave him, as he was leaving the monastery, a New Testament in Latin, and the 2 brickmakers added a New Testament in English, with "The Wicked Mammon" and "The Obedience of a Christian Man." The lay brother ran and hid the books in his cell, and for 2 years read them constantly. At last he was discovered and reprimanded, but he boldly confessed his faith. Upon this the monks threw him into prison, set him in the stocks, put a gag in his mouth, and cruelly whipped him to prevent his speaking of grace. The unhappy Bayfield remained 9 months in this condition. When Barnes repeated his visit to Bury at a later period, he did not find the amiable Chamberlain at the gates of the abbey. Upon inquiry, he learned his condition and immediately took steps to procure his deliverance. Dr. Ruffham came to his aid. "Give him to me," said Barnes. "I will take him to Cambridge." The prior of the Augustines was at that time held in high esteem. His request was granted in the hope that he would lead back Bayfield to the doctrines of the church. But the very reverse took place. Intercourse with the Cambridge brethren strengthened the young monk's faith. On a sudden his happiness vanished. Barnes, his friend and benefactor, was carried to London, and the monks of Bury St. Edmunds, alarmed at the noise of this affair created, summoned him to return to the abbey. But Bayfield, resolving to submit to their yoke no longer, went to London and lay concealed with Maxwell and Stacey. One day, having left his hiding place, he was crossing Lombard Street when he met a priest named Pearson and two other members of his order, with whom he entered into a conversation which greatly scandalized them. "You must depart forthwith," said Maxwell and Stacey to him on his return. Bayfield received a small sum of money from them, went on board a ship, and as soon as he reached the continent, hastened to find Tyndale. During this time, scenes of a very different nature from those which had taken place at Cambridge, but not less heartrending, were passing at Oxford. The storm of persecution was raging there with more violence than at Cambridge. Clarke and the other confessors of the name of Christ were still confined in their underground prison. The air they breathed, the food they took, and they were given nothing but salt fish. The burning thirst this created, the thoughts by which they were agitated, all together combined to crush these noble-hearted men. Their bodies wasted day by day. They wandered like spectres up and down their gloomy cellar. Those animated discussions in which the deep questions then convulsing Christendom were so eloquently debated that were at an end. They were like shadow meeting shadow. Their hollow eyes cast a vague and haggard glance on one another, and, after gazing for a moment, they passed on without speaking. Clarke, Sumner, Bailey, and Goodman, consumed by fever, feebly crawled along, leaning against their dungeon walls. The first, who was also the eldest, could not walk without the support of one of his fellow prisoners. Soon he was quite unable to move, and lay stretched on the damp floor. The brethren gathered round him, sought to discover in his features whether death was not about to cut short the days of him who had brought many of them to the knowledge of Christ. They repeated to him slowly the words of Scripture, and then knelt down by his side and uttered a fervent prayer. Clarke, feeling his end draw near, asked for the communion. The jailers conveyed his request to their master. The noise of the bolts was soon heard, and a turnkey, stepping into the midst of the disconsolate band, pronounced a cruel no. On hearing this, Clarke looked towards heaven and exclaimed with the Father of the Church, "Cred et manducasti," believe and thou hast eaten. He was lost in thought. He contemplated the crucified Son of God. By faith he ate and drank the flesh and blood of Christ, and experienced in his inner life the strengthening action of the Redeemer. Men might refuse him the host, but Jesus had given him his body, and from that hour he felt strengthened by a living union with the King of Heaven. Not alone did Clarke descend into the shadowy valley. Sumner, Bailey, and Goodman were sinking rapidly. Death, the gloomy inhabitant of this foul prison, had taken possession of these four friends. Their brethren addressed fresh solicitations to the Cardinal, at that time closely occupied in negotiations with France, Rome, and Venice. He found means, however, to give a moment to the Oxford martyrs, and just as these Christians were praying over their four dying companions, the commissioner came and informed them that his lordship of his great goodness permitted the sick persons to be removed to their own chambers. Litters were brought, on which the dying men were placed and carried to their rooms. The doors were closed again upon those whose lives this frightful dungeon had not yet attacked. It was the middle of August, 1528. The wretched men who had passed 6 months in the cellar were transported in vain to their chambers and their beds. Several members of the university ineffectually tried by their cares and their tender charity to recall them to life. It was too late. The severities of popery had killed these noble witnesses. The approach of death soon betrayed itself. Their blood grew cold and their limbs stiff, and their bedimmed eyes sought only Jesus Christ, their everlasting hope. Clark, Sumner, and Bailey died in the same week. Goodman followed close upon them. This unexpected catastrophe softened Wolsey. He was cruel only as far as his interest and the safety of the church required. He feared that the death of so many young men would raise public opinion against him, or that these catastrophes would damage his college. Perhaps even some sentiment of humanity may have touched his heart. "Set the rest at liberty," he wrote to his agents, "but upon condition that they do not go above 10 miles from Oxford." The university beheld these young men issue from their living tomb, pale, wasted, weak, and with faltering steps. At that time, they were not men of mark. It was their youth that touched the spectators' hearts. And in after years, they all occupied an important place in the church. They were Cox, who became Bishop of Ely, and tutor to Edward the Prince Royal; Drum, who under Cranmer became one of the 6 preachers at Canterbury; Udall, afterwards Master of Westminster and Eton Schools; Salisbury, Dean of Norwich, and then Bishop of Soder and Man, who in all his wealth and greatness often recalled his frightful prison at Oxford as a title to glory; Ferrer, afterwards Cranmer's chaplain, Bishop of St. David's, and a martyr even unto death after an interval of 30 years; Frith, Tyndale's friend, to whom this deliverance proved only a delay; and several others. When they came forth from their terrible dungeon, their friends ran up to them, supporting their faltering steps, and embraced them amidst floods of tears. Frith quitted the university not long after and went to Flanders. Thus was the tempest stayed which had so fearfully ravaged Oxford. But the calm was of no long duration. An unexpected circumstance became perilous to the cause of the Reformation. The next chapter is The Tempest Against the Truth, 1526. We'll come back to Frith in the future, because he was a man with an extraordinary story and extraordinary courage in standing up for the gospel.